This is a production of Cornell University.
Well, thank you for that very kind introduction. I'm delighted and somewhat baffled to see so many people here on a Friday afternoon. It's great to be back at Cornell. Among other things, it gives us a bit of an opportunity for a family reunion across a number of generations. I've been coming to Cornell, I realize now, for 40 years, since I was a junior in high school, and I always really do love coming back here. The talk I'm going to give explores the issue of strategic advice. Now, most people fantasize about being leaders. They fantasize about all kinds of things, but one of the things people fantasize about is becoming leaders. Actually, most of us end up in one way or another as advisors. At SAIS just last night, in fact, we hosted the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, the most senior flag officer in the United States Armed Forces. And what is his job? As he would freely tell you, he is the president's principal military advisor. All of us, sooner or later, find ourselves giving advice to our peers, to our superiors, to our subordinates, and even in some ways to ourselves. And I think it's worth thinking about how to play that role well. And that's part of what I want to talk about in the context of foreign policy. I will confess that I have a secondary purpose, which is to raise an issue that as an undergraduate and later a graduate student in political science, and we may simply have lower standards, which accounts for the more rapid completion of the PhD, but a question that I often wondered about, which was, not very diplomatically, what relation, if any, does what I am learning in the classroom have to the real world? And I will confess that as a teacher, the same question occurs to me. What relationship does academic activity have to the thing I'm studying, the conduct of foreign policy? Well, advice is one of the ways into that question. And in fact, the issue of advising leaders is central to the origins of political science as a discipline. What is Machiavelli's The Prince, if not a wickedly good, and I do mean both wicked and good, book of advice? There's a large body of literature known as the Mirror of Princes genre to which the prince belongs. And what are so many op-eds, Sunday talk shows, works by people like Fareed Zakaria, and indeed works of political science, if not advice to people in power? Well, to explore these issues, I will, of course, engage in a certain amount of autobiography. But I will also invoke a number of other figures, to include an early 17th century English statesman, Condoleezza Rice, a very morose Boston historian, a Christian moralist who was also a distinguished scholar of English literature, four rabbis, and that noted strategic authority, Gildor the Elf. Now, not surprisingly, I'm going to start with some personal experience. And bear in mind in what I'm about to talk about, all experiences in government are unique. You go into a particular administration at a particular time with a particular set of people. I had a very unusual job, that of counselor of the Department of State. And just to tell you briefly what that is, it's an undersecretary level position, so it's quite senior in the State Department hierarchy. You report directly to the secretary, but you have a certain kind of authority that you can exert over, say, the assistant secretaries, which they don't like. And what you do really depends on what the secretary wants you to do. Some of the things I dealt with, as Professor Logoval mentioned, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, Iraq, counterinsurgency, special projects like when we discovered there was a North Korean nuclear reactor in Syria that nobody had known about, the Russian invasion of Georgia, piracy off Somalia, and rescuing the State Department History Office. So quite a range of issues. And I came to that job from academe knowing that I was going to return to academe. And of course, not surprisingly, I thought a lot about you know, what is it that being a professor enables you to do as an advisor, and what do you take back out of that? Just a few words on what it was like. The rhythm of the day when we were all in town, which was actually pretty rare, would be you'd have a very small meeting with the secretary first thing in the morning. She'd meet with about 8 or 9 of her core aides, of whom I was one. She would then have a larger meeting, which she would go around the room, and all the assistant and deputy assistant secretaries would raise whatever the problem of the day was. During the day, you go off to what's known as deputies committee meetings. They're not actually at the level of deputy secretary of departments, but usually a notch below at the undersecretary level, which is really where the main governmental decisions, at least in our system, get formulated. And then a wrap-up meeting at the end of the day. A lot of my time was spent on the road because the secretary gave me a very clear mandate, indeed guidance, to go places and report back. So on average, I would be going to, particularly to Afghanistan and later on Pakistan, to some extent Iraq, every couple of months, usually for about 10 days at a time, accompanying the Deputy National Security Advisor for Afghanistan and Iraq, Lieutenant General Doug Lute. I would also very frequently accompany the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy on trips to Europe, particularly working with our French colleagues. One of the things nobody believes about the Bush administration, but I'm going to tell you anyhow, we actually had a fantastic relationship with the French for the last 2 years of the administration. And indeed, my colleague, Undersecretary Edelman, was just made a member of the Légion d'honneur by the French government for his service to Franco-American relations. And then some of the time was spent traveling with the secretary. And in some ways, that would be the most some of the most useful advising time, having dinner on an airplane going someplace and alternating between academic gossip and talking about the broad outlines of American foreign policy. Well, what did the professor have to teach the diplomat that I became about giving strategic advice? I would start with the advantage of spending time hanging around in Washington. There are many wonderful things about SAIST. Those of you who are undergraduates, who are interested in international politics, should think about going there after you've done something else with your lives for a few years. Those of you who are graduate students here, it's too late. One of the wonderful things about it, though, is being in Washington. It is, as I once said to somebody, like being Margaret Mead and having tenure at the University of Samoa. You know, the tribes are out there doing their thing. You can observe them very easily, but you don't have to take part in the fertility rites unless you really want to. It goes, however, I would say, beyond just knowing a lot of the actors that you end up dealing with. One of the things about Washington, which I think is misunderstood often, is that it's usually thought of as a kind of insular and parochial town. It's actually, in some ways, the most cosmopolitan town in the country because it's the only town where you can be very sure that there are substantial populations from all 50 states. You know, just think about Congress. Just think about all the aides. Just think about all the journalists. On top of that, think about all the diplomats. Think about all the military people from all over the world. So it's really quite an extraordinary mix. But what about academic skills more narrowly? And in particular, what about the ability of academics, and more precisely political scientists, to give advice to leaders about what they ought to do? Which is something most professors, including myself, think we are eminently qualified to do. Well, the sad fact is, by and large, professors don't do well in government. And in fact, almost all academic references in government are pejorative. As in, if I hear another lecture from the counselor about the history of piracy, I'm going to scream. Or, how was that meeting? Well, it was another one of the undersecretary's seminars. Or, great. More homework from the deputies committee. You really won't find anything positive in an academic reference in government. What is worse, what the career people, the professional diplomats, civil servants, and soldiers think about us professors when we show up is they tend to put us in either of two categories. They believe that either we are dweebs or jerks. Dweebs because we are hopelessly naive, concocting schemes without thinking about or indeed knowing anything about how real decisions get turned into action. Or jerks, arrogant know-it-alls. My advice to future academics or current academics out there is, by the way, to embrace the inner dweeb. Because if they think you are a jerk, it really doesn't make a difference how right you are. Like a tree falling in a forest with no one nearby, an argument made by someone to whom no one will listen goes nowhere. So for that reason, I kept the bow ties. I would also toss out all the jargons, all the models, and this gets a little bit to my concern about the classroom and the real world, because the language of policy discourse is most emphatically the language of common conversation. If at the deputies committee or any other kind of committee you talk about dependent variables and independent variables, the only sound in the room will be faint sighs and the click of rolling eyeballs. Academics usually lack practical knowledge about how things work, and that practical knowledge is basically impossible to acquire unless you're in the middle of it. And I think that's just the way it is. You can acquire a certain amount by pressing your nose up the glass and peering in, but really until you're in the thick of it, you really don't understand how to make things happen. Academics also tend not to play well with each other. We are taught very young to tear one another up, to be extremely critical. And government is a collective enterprise. And if you're not part of a team, no one wants you. But it's not all bleak. Actually, academics can do a lot in government, often, I would say, in that advisory role. If they are broadly read, they will often know more about any given issue or any given country or any given region than anybody else in the system. If people are good teachers, well, if you know how to run an effective seminar, you can actually run a meeting pretty well. It starts on time, it ends on time, it begins somewhere, it ends somewhere, everybody gets heard, the person running the seminar is controlling the discussion but not simply dictating it. That's a pretty good definition of a good meeting in government. As long as you don't write like somebody who's publishing in the American Political Science Review, if you can write effectively, that is a tremendous gift to have in government. And it is also true that academics have this great strength. What we are good at, what we should be good at, is asking childlike questions. I don't mean childish questions, I mean childlike questions, the big questions. For me, the most effective question I ever asked in government was, why do we think this is going to work? Which, remarkably enough, is a question that is almost never asked. And finally, academics have another virtue, which is a virtue in giving advice. And that is, we tend not to be deferential. And I know, because she told me, I was hired precisely because I was known not to be deferential, including to the secretary. And because most governmental organizations are hierarchical, it's very important for somebody at the top to have a person who will discreetly, and I would emphasize discreetly, say, I think that's completely wrong. Well, one might think that giving advice is pretty cool. Having authority without responsibility, what Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin referred to as the prerogative of the harlot throughout the ages. But not quite. And here I would like to invoke that great strategic authority, Gildor the Elf. How many of you have read Lord of the Rings, or at least seen the movie? Okay, most of you. For those of you who haven't, there are these furry little creatures who are sort of the good guys, and they live in Oxfordshire, basically before it got ruined. And one of them has this ring that the enemy really wants, and the enemy is the ultimate baddie. And they're pursuing him. And he's Frodo, who has the ring, is supposed to link up with his friend the wizard Gandalf, and he's being pursued by these black riders who are the ultimate baddies' servants. And they're just about to get him. He is in a complete dither because he was supposed to meet up with Gandalf, and Gandalf hasn't shown up. And so he decides to make a break for it, and he's being pursued by the black riders, and they almost get him, and thank goodness, just in the nick of time, there comes by this troop of elves led by Gildor, the chief elf. And they scare off the black riders, and they then they give the hobbits a decent meal. And Frodo turns to Gildor, and he says, "What do you think I ought to do? Do you think I ought to continue to make a run for it, or go back and wait for Gandalf to show up?" And Gildor says that Gandalf should be late does not bode well. But it is said, "Do not meddle in the affairs of wizards, for they are subtle and quick to anger. The choice is yours, to go or to wait." "It is also said," answered Frodo, "go not to the elves for counsel, for they will say both no and yes." "Is it indeed?" laughed Gildor. "Elves seldom give unguarded advice, for advice is a dangerous gift, even from the wise to the wise, and all courses may run ill." Actually, that's a very profound statement about advice. When you're actually giving advice, the chilling thought hits you, she may actually listen to me, and she may actually make a decision based on what I've suggested. Advice is a dangerous gift, and in part because all courses really may run ill. Any advice, any issue that gets up to the level of a cabinet secretary or certainly a president or a prime minister is a 51-49 decision. More often, it's a 50.1-49.9 decision. The easier decisions have been taken care of much further down. And when you're giving advice, you have to know there's a very good chance that you're wrong. Very close to a 50-50 chance that you're wrong. And that's one of the reasons why one should not enjoy giving advice. When people asked me if I was enjoying being counselor of the Department of State, I said no. I said, was it satisfying? Absolutely. Was I glad that I had taken it on? Yes. Was it interesting? Of course. Had I acquired some truly remarkable friendships? For sure. But enjoyment? No. I was a wartime counselor, and what I kept on my desk throughout my tenure was the picture of the son of a friend of mine who was killed in Iraq on about the second week that I was in government service. Well, what does it mean to give strategic advice? The first thing one has to realize is that the notion that an advisor somehow sees more clearly into the future than the boss, or that simply an advisor knows more than the boss, is often untrue. Inevitably, an advisor's view is much more partial, much more limited than that of the boss, that of number one, the person at the top. There will be considerations that weigh on them that you don't know. And that can be the case even if you are working side by side with them. And that's quite deliberate. There's a wonderful essay called Of Counsel by Francis Bacon, who is both a literary man and a statesman. And one of the things he says is, as to secrecy, princes are not bound to communicate all matters with all counselors, but may extract and select. He says they should extract and select. You don't tell anybody everything. You don't get to the top by being trusting that way. Nobody, no matter how good they are, gets to the top by being completely open with anybody in their circle. Nor is it the case that you simply say, well, this is what I think you ought to do, in the way that you read it in an op-ed or hear some pundit talking on the television. To understand why, I think it's important to understand how utterly murky policymaking is. One of the most remarkable eulogies I ever read was by Winston Churchill for Neville Chamberlain. Chamberlain was already quite ill with cancer when World War II began. He died in November 1940. Churchill had become prime minister, of course, in May. And Churchill gave the eulogy. Now, Churchill had been about as massively vindicated over Neville Chamberlain as you might, as any human being could be. And this is what he said at his eulogy for Neville Chamberlain. "It is not given to human beings, happily for them, for otherwise life would be intolerable, to foresee or to predict to any large extent the unfolding course of events. In one phase, men seem to have been right, in another, they seem to have been wrong. Then again, a few years later, when the perspective of time has lengthened, all stands in a different setting. There is a new proportion, there is another scale of values." He concluded, by the way, saying, "The only guide to a man is his conscience. The only shield to his memory is the rectitude and sincerity of his actions. Because we are so often mocked by the failure of our hopes and the upsetting of our calculations." And as I said, that's from a man who was about as massively vindicated as it is ever given to a politician to be. Policymakers don't only not know the likely consequences of their own action, they often don't even know what's going on. Neither, by the way, does anybody else. A former student of mine who was the Washington Post's White House correspondent once confided to me, pointing at the White House, "We really have no idea what's going on in there." Government is very much a giant game of telephone. That may be what our ambassador to NATO reported hearing from the Secretary General in Brussels on Tuesday, but it's not what the German foreign minister said to the secretary at the Quad in London on Wednesday. That's what the atmosphere of government is all about, and it's very confusing. There is, moreover, a lag, particularly in wartime. This was really very clear, for example, in the case of Iraq. What was going on in Anbar province in 2007 was known in the capital of Anbar province, usually within a couple of weeks. It took about another 2 to 4 weeks before that really kind of sunk in Baghdad. And it took at least another month, and I would say usually two, before that was fully understood in Washington. So there's a lot of stumbling around, and with it, a lot of wishful thinking. In such an environment, where really what most policymakers are trying to do is get along day by day, big, bold, snappy ideas are often more of a nuisance than anything else. And big, snappy ideas have other problems associated with them. Let me describe two of those in terms of what I think of as my own two migrations from the world of 65-35 to the world of 90-10. The first, when I went in, I prided myself on being very worldly and thinking that policy itself was about 65% implementation and 35% conceptualization. And I thought I was actually a remarkably hard-headed professor for thinking that. I was, of course, completely wrong. Policy is about 90% about implementation and 10% or less about conceptualization. Think, for example, about President Obama's pledge to close Guantanamo. Whoever came up with that big idea, and it may have been the president himself, was completely clueless about how hard that was going to prove to do. The challenge of implementation is why the particular competence of senior invisible people is so important. People like my friend Lieutenant General Douglas Lute, who I'm sure most of you have never heard of and most of you never will, who was retained, fortunately, by the Obama administration as the Deputy National Security Advisor now for Afghanistan and Pakistan. It makes a huge difference if you have somebody like General Lute who can run a meeting, who can hold people to an agenda, who can come to conclusions, and who, above all, can hold people's feet to the fire without driving them to revolt. By the way, most professors lack those skills. Those that do sometimes become department chairmen or deans, and thereby usually earn the contempt and hatred of their colleagues. The second migration that I made from 65-35 to 90-10 is thinking that, going in, thinking that policymaking is maybe about 65% about personality and about 35% about substance. And there again, I made a mistake. Policymaking is about 90% about personalities, The disciplines that I wish I had when I went in were less political science and much more cognitive and social psychology, with a dash of anthropology, also very useful, and about 10% substantive argument. And finally, there's another reason why simply coming up with the big ideas and laying them out for the boss is not all that it's cracked up to be. The truth is, speaking truth to power is not all that it's cracked up to be. Francis Bacon, I think, was not right when he also wrote in Of Counsel that the true composition of a counselor is rather to be skillful in their master's business than in his nature. In other words, you should know the topic. You shouldn't be particularly interested in what kind of person his superior is. For then he is like to advise him and not feed, to advise him and not feed his humor. Actually, I think that's not true. I think to be an effective advisor, you have to really study your boss very closely. And when you do study them, you realize what an incredibly distracted life they lead. I watched Secretary Rice jump from making decisions and being briefed on and then trying to make decisions to affect the rate of fill of provincial reconstruction teams in Iraq, to the next phone call from the Russian foreign minister, to how to get more votes on Capitol Hill for the Colombia Free Trade Agreement, to how on earth you'd try to get the Greeks to go along with Macedonia being called Macedonia, which, by the way, was a very serious issue, which took up a lot of time for the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs. And that's on top of intensive congressional testimony, press scrutiny, the knowledge that you are always on. What that means is there are times when superiors, in fact, most of the time, superiors cannot hear truth. Or as my friend David Gordon, the director of the policy planning staff, used to say, speaking truth to power once every couple of months in an op-ed, that's great. If you do it every day and in person, power gets seriously pissed off. So how does an advisor help the boss figure their way through the murk? What is it that an advisor can actually do? An advisor may have more time to study a particular issue, to include getting a first-hand look at it. In particular, they have the opportunity, which usually the principal does not have, to see things for themselves. I think that was probably the most useful thing that I did, being a set of eyes on the ground for the secretary in places like Afghanistan and Pakistan. Good decision makers always want to see for themselves, and particularly in the modern era when it's easy to do, when you can hop on an airplane, they will try. But in the nature of things, they live in such a cocoon that it's impossible. And if implementation is the really hard part of government, if it's the decisive part of government, as I believe it is, a large part of an advisor's job is monitoring whether or not implementation is actually going on. And of course, most of the time, it isn't. But an advisor can find that out. Secondly, a good advisor may not be able to figure out the truth for the reasons I've indicated. But they can be quite useful at figuring out untruth, which is almost as valuable. And in any large foreign policy-making organization, there's a lot of untruth. Or, I should say, because it's usually not sinister, sloppy efforts to come up with the truth which end up yielding falsehood. Example I'll give is it's kind of a bumper sticker that was briefed frequently, and I saw this happen to both the President, the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, to the effect that 75% of the violence in Afghanistan was happening in only 10% of the districts there. And I saw this being briefed in National Security Council meetings and video teleconferences by very senior career official. This was not the political people. This was the military commander on the ground and the ambassador, the Assistant Secretary of State, and so on. And the job in that case that I took upon myself was that just sounded strange. And so, like a good academic, I began digging. And not with anything, but no regression analyses needed. But first, do we know what's going on in all 376 districts of Afghanistan? For that matter, do we have people in all 376 districts of Afghanistan? The answer is no. So that's the first problem. That it starts off bogus there. Secondly, how do you measure violence? Well, it's violence directed against us or violence that we initiate against the Taliban. Well, in an insurgency, maybe the relevant measure of violence is violence directed against the civilian population. And thirdly, is violence the right metric to use in any case? If we go into a valley and we drive out the Taliban and we have 10 firefights, and then everything is fine for the next 51 weeks, is that a worse situation than the next valley over where the Taliban just behead one local chief, the place that goes completely quiet because everybody's gotten the message, and they're running that valley? Okay, one valley is 10 times as violent as the next one. Again, this is not rocket science in the slightest, but it's the kind of question that senior people surprisingly often don't ask, and advisors can ask. Thirdly, an advisor can help by easing internal communication and cooperation. Many of you, I'm sure, will be familiar with that old saw of organizational politics: where you stand depends on where you sit. In my experience, that's completely untrue. The way government works, I believe, is by what I think of as leagues of the like-minded. That you have like-minded people in different bureaucracies, some of whom are personal friends from before, some of whom maybe have just met one another, but who have a similar sort of worldview, and they kind of concert policy together, and they try to drive the process in a particular direction. And effective advisors can be part of those leagues of the like-minded. Well, let me conclude by just saying a few words about the perils of power, because I think those afflict both leaders and their advisors. One of my great teachers in graduate school was a political theorist named Judith Schlar. And I remember her once saying to an assembled throng of graduate students, you become a political scientist because you are either fascinated by power or horrified by it. She was a refugee from the Second World War, so it was quite clear where on that spectrum she came out. I don't think I understood that when she was saying it to me. But as I've gone on, I think I've come to believe that she was right. The exercise of power involves a number of distorting effects. And particularly since I'm sure there's some people in this room who will go on to be powerful people. By the way, two of my colleagues at least were Cornell graduates. Three. The National Security Advisor, Steve Hadley, was a Cornell graduate. Undersecretary Edelman, Cornell graduate. And Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, Dan Freed, Cornell. I'm sure there's some assistant secretaries, undersecretaries, national security advisors sitting out there right now. So this is directed at you. The exercise of power, or at least the quest for it, involves a number of distorting effects. One of these is the quest to get inside what C.S. Lewis once called the inner ring. C.S. Lewis, of course, the Narnia books, but also a literary scholar and a prolific Christian moralist. And he gave a quite wonderful speech to a group of British undergraduates in 1944. There's no reference to World War II. It's about what he calls the inner ring. And what he says is, in any organization, he referred to his own military experience in World War I, in any organization, there's an inner ring. There's the kind of the club at the center. You know, in high school, it's the cool kids. But there's an inner ring just about anywhere. And he says it can be formalized in different ways, but it's there. And sooner or later, you are going to be desperate to get inside the inner ring. Of all the passions, Lewis wrote, the passion for the inner ring is most skillful in making a man who is not yet a very bad man do very bad things. It is the very mark of a perverse desire that it seeks what is not to be had. The desire to be inside the invisible line illustrates this rule. As long as you are governed by that desire, you will never get what you want. You are trying to peel an onion. If you succeed, there will be nothing left. And he says, until you conquer the fear of being an outsider you will remain. Well, the truth is, very few people conquer the fear of being an outsider, particularly in government. And government offers the tastiest and juiciest of all inner rings. The inner ring in government is small because it has to be small. The people inside it are doing very important things. And they will often find themselves compromising their beliefs and their ideals in order to get in. So the proximity to power and the quest for it can do distorting things. Power has a huge effect on ego, and with it the capacity for friendship. Henry Adams, a great historian, a very rather strange guy, the grandson and great-grandson of two presidents, writing, I think, about people that he knew in Washington, including his own friend, John Hay, who became Secretary of State, and whom he sort of wanted to advise. The effect of power and publicity on all men is the aggravation of self, a sort of tumor that ends by killing the victim's sympathies, a diseased appetite, like a passion for drink or perverted tastes. And in his autobiography, The Education of Henry Adams, which he wrote in the third person, which says something about him, he describes himself as taking invariably for granted, as a political instinct, without waiting further experiment, as he took for granted that arsenic poisoned, the rule that a friend in power is a friend lost. Well, I'm a little bit less dark than that. I think I made some lifelong friends in government. I think I know people who are not corrupted by it. But I think I know what he meant. Exercising power, to include advising people who exercise power, means entering a cocoon. Particularly in the White House, but I would say anywhere near the top of this government or any other government, you're surrounded by extremely able, deferential people. You have the trappings of power, which are considerable. You're not being paid very much. But you have black limousines, you have aides, you have advance parties. If you're going someplace dangerous, you have big, beefy bodyguards carrying all kinds of firearms and knives and things. What's worse, you're surrounded by people who will tell you, explicitly or implicitly, that you are an extraordinary gifted person. The only thing that's almost as corrupting is being a professor. You can feel power, particularly in places like the White House. And I would argue the most corrupting person there, the guy who actually could play Screwtape in C.S. Lewis's Screwtape Letters, which is a wonderful book about the devil, is the White House photographer. Now, why is the White House photographer the original tempter? Because if you go in the West Wing of the White House, forget the stupid TV show, what you have on the walls are decorated with these wonderful photographs taken by the White House photographer, who's a very good photographer, of the great man, and thus far it's only been a great man, the great man being adored by crowds, or in heroic postures of one kind or another. And just so that nobody will get bored, every 2 weeks, those pictures are taken down and replaced with new pictures of the president being adored by the crowds or adopting heroic postures. And that's corrupting. It's corrupting for the president, and it's corrupting for everybody who works for him. At the same time, if you're high up in government, and again, I think this is true of any government, and it's true of advisors as well. Your life is one of relentless hurry. No vacation is uninterrupted. Actually, you feel badly if it's not interrupted because it means you're not really important, which gets back to that inner ring thing that I was talking about. So my wife and I were going cross-country skiing in West Virginia, I pretended to be unhappy that I got an urgent phone call on my BlackBerry in the wilderness, but actually I felt really cool, right? So no vacation is uninterrupted. Your day is cut up into 15-minute chunks. Everybody wants something from you. And your opponents, that includes people in the government, but particularly people on the outside, are attacking you ceaselessly, unfairly, and falsely. They don't understand, including former people who you thought were friends. By the way, don't believe any senior figure who tells you that they don't read the criticism. They all do, and they remember. The result of all this is that sooner or later, and by and large it's sooner, you go into the bunker. And once you're in the bunker, you make mistakes. And the longer you're in the bunker, the less you understand the world outside it. Now, part of an advisor's job is to remind the boss that they're living in the bunker. But the problem is that the advisor is in the bunker too. And that is why, as Enoch Powell, a very flawed English politician, once said, all political lives end in failure. And I think by and large, that's pretty much true. All political lives do end in failure. So if that hasn't deterred the future assistant and undersecretaries out there, let me try to give you some advice. And I'm going to turn to a story that I read many years ago, and that is about 18 centuries old. And this is where the four rabbis come in. It's a story from the Talmud, and it's very typically Talmudic. It's a very cryptic little story. There were four rabbis who went into the orchard. Ben Azai, Ben Zoma, Elisha ben Abuya, who the other rabbis later on called the Other, and Akiva. Ben Azai died. Ben Zoma went mad. Elisha ben Abuya lost his faith. Akiva came out in peace. Now, of course, you then get reams and reams of commentary. What does this sort of little Kafkaesque story mean? Some people think, well, the orchard is mystical studies. And this is to show you the danger of studying Kabbalah and mysticism. Others say, no, actually what the orchard was, what was known as Greek studies, so the study of philosophy, truly secular studies. Again, shows you this stuff can be dangerous. But I think it fits government service actually as well, to include being an advisor. An orchard is an appealing place. And I always think of it as kind of a walled orchard. You know, you can see the tops of the trees, and you can see the fruit. And you think that must be a really interesting place to go in. And among other things, you can, you know, eat yourself sick. But it's a pretty good metaphor for what happens to people. Some people are truly destroyed by government service. Truly destroyed. One of my first teachers was killed in government service. Somebody named Joe Kruzel, who was a wonderful teacher. He served in the Clinton administration as a deputy assistant secretary of defense. He was traveling in a convoy with Richard Holbrooke. This was on the mountain right outside Sarajevo. And they were going too fast because they were trying to get to the airport very quickly. And his APC turned over and he was killed. But people are destroyed in other ways too. I mean, I've seen people, not really through some major fault of their own, have their careers completely shattered and their lives completely shattered. Divorce, really unable to kind of put themselves back together again because of having been very close to power. Other people go mad, and you can go mad in a variety of ways. I don't mean in the sense of being put in a straitjacket, but you can be driven mad by ambition or by resentment, and the result is you can end up as a very different kind of human being than what you came out. You can lose your faith the way Elisha ben Abuya did. I'm not talking in religious terms, but you can lose your faith in human nature. You can lose your faith in the ideals that you believed in going in. You can lose your faith in the United States government, and many people do. So the question is, how do you come out like Akiva? And the Talmud, again, very cryptic, says, all it says is that Akiva Allah b'shalom, the Akiva Yarad b'shalom, that Akiva went in peace, and he went out in peace. And I think that the commentary on that makes the most sense to me is that in the Hebrew, peace and whole are the same words, the same three-letter root. That Akiva went in whole as a kind of an integrated personality. And I think that's actually the most important thing to take away. And so here I'm going to step away from being an advisor in the sense of government and revert to being a professor. I think particularly for those of you who are thinking about government service, what I would urge you to do, particularly at this stage when you are really kind of putting yourselves together, because that's what one does as a student I think, as an undergraduate and as a graduate student, you figure out who you really are, and you put together the building blocks of your personality and your core beliefs, which will carry you on forever, that you think about making sure that that's an integrated whole. And I think if you do that, you may have a pretty good chance of going in as either a decision maker or as an advisor and coming out whole, which is about the best thing I can wish for you. So that concludes my remarks. I'm happy to take any questions or comments you might have.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.